This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're revisiting the always popular theme of speaking up as a factor in mental health, but of course, such a factor in stigma in particular and fighting back against it. We also have a wonderful repeat guest joining me today, Terry Maguire, who is the co-host of the Giving Voice to Depression podcast, an incredible bite-sized interview show. The interviews tend to be 10 to 15 minutes that span the incredibly broad spectrum of what it is to live with depression, all the ways in which the symptoms can vary from person to person, all the different types of support that's available. And in particular, Terry talks about in this episode how that's a big part of what inspires her to keep doing the show, is hearing how over 300 episodes in, she's still finding new tools, new approaches people are finding that are helping, even having spoken to that many people already. I was delighted to catch up with her again, and I think it's no coincidence maybe her coming from a TV and radio voiceover kind of background. She's definitely one of the most articulate people I know. It comes through in the metaphors and anecdotes that she gives. In particular, I'll always remember one she told me about previously of how working on understanding her own depression better had sort of become like a train coming into a station. When it was getting bad, she was learning to hear the train whistling off in the distance, to feel the rumbling on the station platform, as opposed to it being when the depression is here in full, parked to your platform, then you're like, oh, here it is, I need to do something. At a time when it's the most difficult to do something about it, thanks to the same depression. So in the episode, we also talk a lot about how Terry's work in particular has steered more these days towards suicide prevention, with the link to depression being so clear there, and some of the factors in her own life that have at times complicated this experience of speaking up, and also, of course, how great the impact has been in terms of those she connects with all over the world who tune into her show, who hear her talk, who have had the privilege of meeting her. So I think that's all I'll say for now. Wonderful conversation. I relate to Terry a lot. I think you'll even hear in the episode us realizing just how many parallels we were finding in real time of our experiences. And, you know, that's always fun. And I get to have that. I get to have those pleasant surprises that I guess are distinct to where I'm at. You know, I think a much younger me would not be so excited to find out how much my trauma was similar to other people's. And it feels like quite a nice place to be in, to realize like, oh, the difficult times in our lives, they're similar. How exciting. When as a younger person, I would have wanted to run from a lot of those conversations. I certainly wouldn't have known how to have them and how to find the joy that can come from connecting and finding similar ground in this way. So great catching up with Terry. And I think like a lot of our episodes recently, we get to have a bit of a chuckle in there as well. So that's all I'm going to say for now. We'll get into the episode. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
So I started the Giving Voice to Depression podcast after I had a really serious and long bout of depression. I would say 2 years of my life was greatly impacted and in some ways lost. And because neither I nor anyone in my sphere talked about depression or mental health in general, I didn't recognize it as that. I didn't even recognize it as medical, even though I had years and years past been diagnosed with depression and taken antidepressants. That tells you how affected you can be, because one of the symptoms of depression is it convinces you you don't have it. And when I realized, first of all, how dangerous it was and how far I was sliding and sought medical attention, it was weeks before I felt better. And I was so mad at myself, which, you know, is not especially healthy, but at stigma, at society, that in that time, no one said to me, hey, this could be depression. You should see a doctor, when we both know if I'd been limping for 2 years, you know, how many people would have told me I needed to get an x-ray?
Oh, yeah. People in the street. Strangers. Yeah. Everyone.
Exactly. Exactly. So when I got healthier, which again happened shockingly quickly compared to how long I was unhealthy, I was like, oh no, I had to find some value so that wasn't just exclusively lost time. And so I decided to try to reach people like me who might have been in bed, who were alone, who were just thinking that life as they knew it themselves, as they knew themselves, was gone. And sort of reaching people who don't reach out. So that's sort of the origin story of my podcast.
I love that. And I didn't realize quite how similar our experiences were on that I could steal exactly what you said there as the audio for a lot of the reasoning behind this show. And, you know, I try and wherever I can find that fun nuance between, whilst we wouldn't necessarily choose a lot of these experiences, there can be a lot of good that comes from them. But, you know, that is in tandem with the right support and people believing us and us pushing past stigma. And, you know, like we'll be talking about today, us finding our ways to speak up about what we're going through, the reality for us.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, you know, the same way that you could take my story and make it yours. If we speak of our experience of depression or when people do, it's often the same as mine. You know, we are each other. We share a lot more in common than the world would have us right now, you know, believe divides us. And so it's really a nice thing when, I mean, it's a terrible thing to be like, oh yeah, I have depression too. Isn't it awful? I didn't want to live either. I don't mean it's a nice thing to share, but it is good to know that we're not alone in the experience.
There's a solidarity in it. And I was giggling there because even what you said there, I'm forever saying far more unites us than divides us. So we're so on the same hymn sheet there with this stuff. And in terms of when you then started the podcast, what was the contrast like for you in terms of how much you spoke about mental health and specifically depression before?
Before?
Yeah.
Oh, before I didn't speak of it at all. Not at all.
And I know from talking to you previously, a lot of that was, you know, it wasn't something that was necessarily talked about growing up. The stigma that we all experienced was very much part of your story. And so that still feels like a big contrast to go from never talking about it to then how public a podcast is. And of course, when you record it, you always end up thinking about, certainly I did in the early days, all the people you don't want to hear it. You end up almost like accidentally making it a little bit for them because that's who's in the back of your mind.
Absolutely. And I started it with my little sister. I now have a different co-host, but for the first 5 years, we did it together. And we liken it to having joined hands and jumped into the deep end, right? It was just like, well, if we're going to do this, let's do this. Neither of our families knew that we had depression. Our children didn't. You know, I think our parents did. Our siblings didn't. But again, I was not hiding that. This wasn't self-stigma. This wasn't me being ashamed to say. Nobody cared. Nobody wanted to hear it. You know, the times even during that depression that I said, like, I almost didn't come again. You know, I had to drag myself here and I feel like I'm watching this meal I am joining like through a window, you know, that I'm not actually present. Mm-hmm. I'm just sort of here. And you get that like, yeah, you used to be more fun. That's not a good conversation, you know, like Debbie Downer or something, which is probably showing my age, but it wasn't like, oh, my friend has something that is causing her distress and unrest and you know, pain. It was, my friend isn't fun anymore.
Yeah. And that specific part of it is so strange to me because it can be weirdly formulaic sometimes the way people communicate. And, you know, we have the big contrast now that we're known as people that talk about mental health. And I'm sure you get it all the time, where as soon as you mention what you do, or as soon as you meet someone that's listened to your work, then they're only too keen to share with you. And that's so wonderful. Absolutely. That we're perceived in that safe space kind of a way.
Absolutely.
And I wonder how much of that is to do with the stigma, right? That maybe some of your friends and family, even though many of them would have been well-meaning, there's something about not quite naming it that everyone can just kind of dance around. And then actually, if you're the one that names it, yes, maybe some people are uncomfortable, but there's also a lot of people that can breathe out and be like, oh, okay, we've passed the threshold now. It's been said. It's on the floor. We can discuss it.
And in my experience, that reaction has come from other people with depression or who, you know, love, care about, know somebody with it, not from my inner circle, friends or family. Mm-hmm. You know, 6 years into my podcast, I still have never had a friend say, hey, now that I know, how would I know? You know, because I live alone and I live far from them. So, you know, it's not like, oh, she didn't show up or I didn't see her. She's not, because they seldom do. So how would we know if you needed us? How would we know if you needed support? I've never been asked that question. I really do feel like a lot of people, and this includes some family, I'm believe it or not, I have a good sense of humor. And so like my role is to make a situation lighter, to provide some laughter. When I'm depressed, that is not happening. And so I am just a disappointing guest. But yeah, no, I have not, even in my own family and circle, really had these discussions. So I'm really grateful and humbled and honored to have them so regularly and to get to the real stuff, because I just can't do small talk. It is just not in my genetics. I don't care about the weather. I don't care about a lot of things. But I'll get real about anything, including this. I probably have to back off a little bit talking about mental health all the time. But hey, I've got a mission, you know, and that's what it feels like.
Yeah. And I don't know if you had this, but I think there does kind of come a point where you become quite satiated by it, that we can spend so long not talking about certain things. And for me, I didn't realize just how much I was holding back, just how much I was like swapping out words and dumbing things down. Even when I did have the diagnoses and I wasn't, you know, I had the awareness, or I wasn't kind of avoiding looking at certain things I knew might be wrong with me. But even still, it can take a while to realize how much you're avoiding certain topics. And then when you are speaking up about it and getting into that habit of it, I find now that I've sort of come back to the other side of the bell curve a little bit, where it's not something I'm kind of bursting at the seams to talk about anymore. I'm always ready for the conversation. Like I'm always kind That's of primed. Good. I always have thoughts on it if somebody brings something up, and I'm ready to support people, you know, where appropriate. But I found that, you know, this therapy campaigning work I do, I think it's maybe finally caught up on the sort of, you know, the little kid that had a lot of, you know, feelings that couldn't be expressed.
Nice. That's very healing.
Yeah. It's good. It's a nice place to be. And I think, you know,
I like the way you put that.
Thank you. And I know that it's something that you have so much with your guests, that you have this way of really connecting with people, and the episodes you do are really short, so you have to build that rapport really quickly. I remember when you interviewed me, we were straight into it. I had to check with you. I'm sure you edited out, but I had to check with you. Oh, so we're in the interview now, because you're just so seamless with that.
I do. I just go right. That's my approach to life.
Yeah.
My approach is starting the podcast right, that holding hands, jumping in the deep end. It's like, yep, we're already off. Mm-hmm. That's funny. The reason I named it Giving Voice to Depression is I was a voice talent. I've been a voice talent for 40 plus years. So I had literally used my voice, you know, to earn my living and, you know, to put messages out in the world. So for me to turn it to this was sort of natural and sort of like, wow, a total change. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes is that speak your truth even if your voice shakes. So for me, speaking out, the voice part of it is really literal, you know.
And then with using your voice, with this becoming such a part of your routine, did you notice then changes with how you viewed your depression? Were you then finding just how much you were normalizing it for yourself?
Not only normalizing it, but I have not experienced it as much. I have learned, and this can sound so formulaic or trite, that I have learned from every guest. But when I say that, I 100% mean it. And I believe that everyone sharing their, I call them mental health tools, but the ways that they manage to realize there are so many different ways. And so, you know, it's not just go outside and take a walk and journal. You know, there are a thousand others, thousands of others. And also the simple act of having something that I consider important and of value to do fights that thought that depression, you know, tries to hammer me with and many of us with, that we have no value in this world. And it's like, oh, no, no, you need to shut up, because I do, because this is important and this is helping people. And if nothing else in my life is of value, I know that this is. So it has made it easier for me to fight back, if that's the right term, those thoughts. And so I think having this has helped me in all kinds of ways. I mean, at this exact moment, and it has been true for years now, I went off antidepressants. I'll go back on tomorrow if the knocking starts getting louder. I hear that Jaws music, you know, dun, 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 dun. And I know it's coming, because I'm not waiting until I'm leveled with it again. But I've also learned that, to notice the early warning signs. And it's like, ooh, I am getting really short-tempered, and that is not my MO. So I know that if I'm starting to be, you know, really snippy or road ragey or any of those things, like, oh, you need to watch it. And I shared with you that my mother recently died. And in anticipation of the fact that I knew that could level me and cause me to slide into a depression, I started therapy a year before. I mean, she was 98. So, you know, it was like, wait, you know, how are you not knowing this is coming? You need to get a little bit ahead of this, or you're in real danger. So I would never have done that before I did this podcast or talked to the guests. So I think that hearing so many people's stories gives me hope as well.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Hope and tools. Yeah.
Hope and tools. That's what I love. And am I right in thinking that with your mother, you kind of had like a scare with her health, and that was part of you? You got that.
Yes.
You got a warning there of some of the symptoms.
It was
symptoms.
A fire drill. Mm-hmm.
And so with the therapy you then went, was that very specifically that you approached it, that you went to a therapist and says, this is something I know will be in the future, and I want to work on tools now?
Yes. Sooner than later. Again, she was almost 98. Mm-hmm. You know, weeks away from 98. That's not an if, that's a when. And I said, you know, I mean, there isn't a person on this planet, I think, who doesn't have, with anyone, they're going to lose under any circumstance. Some I's they wish they could dot and some T's they wish they could cross if they had a warning, right? And so that's what I wanted to do, so that when the time came, I could release her with peace. I'm still grieving, and look at me, I'm still grieving. But I'm in a very different place mentally than I believe I would be, because a year ago, when we had what I'll call the fire drill, I was not okay. I was weepy. I was, you know, at her side. I was just, riled up doesn't sound like the right word, but internally that's how I felt. I was very agitated.
Like shaking.
And yeah, just everything was just whoosh. And as her death neared this time, is it for the only time, I was very at peace, and I was able to convey that peace to her, which I think was important too. It was, you know, you can, I'll meet you up there. Which is a very different energy than, you know, mommy, don't leave, you know, when she had to. Why would you do that to her, you know, or to myself?
Yeah. And that's so tough to go through that work, but I can see how much it helped. And, you know, when I've lost family, I've tried to take that same approach. You know, I think the funeral is for the people that are left behind, and I think the final days are for that person. And that's so easier said than done. You know, that rolls off the tongue.
So easier said than done.
But it sounds like, you know, getting the opportunity to pre-grieve in many ways meant that you could be there in the way that you thought would be the most helpful for her at the end.
Yep. And what did I want to say to her before it was the end? You know, what did I want to communicate? You know, 60 years is a long time to be in a relationship with someone.
And did you also find that there were things brought up that you maybe wanted to, you know, talk through with her, or, you know, certain questions you had that, you know, maybe you would have missed the, you know, the chance, and maybe would have regretted never asking?
Regret. That was exactly what I was trying to avoid. It was just, you know, what would I look back and think, ooh, I wish I'd asked. And that can be anything from what was your childhood like, you know, to what was mine like, and everything in between.
Mm-hmm. That's so beautiful that you had that. And we were talking off air about how, it's funny even having, well, I joke about it because it's an ongoing trope for me that so often me looking after myself comes via my work. That like I started doing self-care properly when I got into modeling. I went back to therapy when, around the time that I started this show, actually slightly before. And we were both saying that we have the experience of, trying to follow, our own good advice or, yes. wonderful things that the guests say to right. us, great tools, right. even more because we know the spotlight is on us in a different way. And whilst that can be a lot of pressure, there can actually be something quite helpful to, it's not always easy to keep yourself accountable.
And I'll freely share when I'm not, because there are times somebody's talking and yesterday I did an interview and Wally is his name. And he was sharing how he has taken the personal inventories from several AA 12-step programs and made his own. And that he very, very regularly and consciously checks in with himself to see where he is and asks himself questions like, am I being true to myself? Am I living according to my values? What is my greatest strength right now? What do I think is my weakness and what can I do to, work with that? I have never asked myself those questions. Do I live the most unexamined life on this planet? I was just like, wow. Knowing that about yourself could really be helpful. And if you see that you are moving away from your center in either direction, getting yourself back, I liken it to, I used to work in video, so a tripod, right? If you stand with your feet apart and it's really windy or someone bumps into you, you can take that blow. But if you're, what's the flamingo or whatever that stands on one leg and you get bumped, well, you're going over. Mm-hmm. So, it just helps steady you for life's storms. But I haven't done it. So I was just really, those are the things that when I hear them, I just think, I'm not doing life right, but I could do it better. I could do it better and it would be healthier. And I'm grateful for that because, I went through my self-help book stage. I don't anymore. But when I hear someone speaking who I know has at least as many issues is a very baggagey word, but as many challenges. And he, I would say, has considerably more because of chronic pain. And they're doing that. That challenges me a bit. It's like, wow, you can live better. You can tarry better.
I like that. You can tarry better. It's true though. It's a constant learning process. And whilst I do a lot of work within the area of mental health education, because I would love us to grow up with so many more of these tools.
Yes.
There is a lot of it we have to find for ourselves. You've already said about like all the things that are specific warnings to you. Specific mm-hmm. markers that, okay, that, I'm at risk of the depression coming back in a big way here. And what right. can I do to preempt that or sort of steer it off?
Right. And there are times, you round a corner and poof, there it is. But I'm learning now that there are lots of times there were warning signs before I hit that corner. And I was unaware of that before I started hearing other people's stories. Because I was like, oh, yeah, I get that too. I get that too. I get that tap on the shoulder.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the most wonderful learnings of getting to have conversations like this, that we can make zero assumptions about whose experiences will connect with most. Just because we right. both have experience of depression doesn't necessarily mean that it'll be massively similar. There'll be a lot of broad brushstrokes. But equally, there's people that I speak to that have very different diagnoses or very different backgrounds, or they're a different kind of age or different demographics to me. And I can find it's like they're telling parts of my story.
Interesting.
There's so many assumptions we can make.
Yep. It's why the world is where the world is right now. Yeah, so yeah. many assumptions we can make.
But mm-hmm. talking about it definitely helps. And for you, you've said that it hasn't changed as much with family and with a lot of your friends. What have you seen in terms of the reaction publicly to you speaking up?
I think that people sort of say, well, good for you. The people I know. The people I don't know say thank you. you know, the ones who speak to me, and I don't, you know, I certainly don't know my, I can't, couldn't possibly know our every listener. When I speak in public, when I speak at a school, when I set up a table at a suicide prevention event or mental health event, people are grateful, as you said, for the safe space. They're grateful that you can talk about it, and I'm going to use the word normal, even though I don't really like it, but like it's something normal, like it's common, because it is. Mm-hmm. And if they are living under, oh my gosh, think about suicide loss survivors. I mean, they've got the suddenness and the loss and the grief, and then they're supposed to feel, might feel, often feel shades of guilt, shame, all those things piled on top. What a load. What a load. And when I go to AFSP, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention events, and there are beads for all different things. You know, I live with a mental health condition. I support someone who does. And the white beads are for people who've lost a child. And I can't even say that without tearing up, let alone see it. And when I'm behind that table, I mean, literally, I just have to say, can I hug you? You know, if it feels appropriate. And I've held so many parents. I mean, that is just, can't even talk about it without crying. So I think that it allows us, wow, just that connection, just that it's not I understand, because I have not experienced that loss, but I certainly empathize with people who have, and I have children, and you don't have to have children to understand pain. But it's next level connection. You know, it's not, I played softball too. You know, it is as real as it gets when you connect with somebody about what is likely their greatest pain or deepest secret. I mean, it is a privilege and it is an honor. And as tired as I've gotten and as burned out as I've gotten and as hard as COVID was, every time I think about quitting, somebody writes and says something about how either the podcast or our daily posts or our Facebook community helps them. And then I go, how can I stop? How can I stop? You know, I think we're all here for a reason. I've had two missions so far. One was, you know, raising my children, and I believe this is my second.
Yeah. I relate to that a lot. And, you know, the way I was thinking about it as you described that was, you know, we really just don't have to understand. We have to try. And yes, in many ways,
I love that.
That can be even more beautiful sometimes.
I love
you
that.
You know, to admit that we don't know what somebody's going through, but we're willing to go there and face the really tough emotions. We're willing to, you know, step into it with them as best we can and then not be alone. And, you know, that is something that is both one of the most beautiful things I get to witness and be a part of, but also I think one of the scariest because of how absent that can be in a lot of people's lives, you know, the amount of times.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't even begin to count how many times I've been the first person somebody's told something to.
Right.
And I would actually say the vast majority of the time, it is things I've never experienced. But me as a stranger, I can be a safe space that someone may have never had in their life. The connection is incredible, but also there is, yeah, like you, there's always that piece of, well, this is why we do it. This is why we keep going.
I used to joke about it because it wasn't, the stakes were different. But I was a news reporter, and my then husband would say, I can't believe they pay you to interview people, because you don't even have to interview people. People come to you and tell you their stories. And there was, you know, I don't know what about my 20s, 30s, and 40s made me very approachable, but I couldn't get through a grocery line without someone telling me what their medical condition was or their, you know, challenge in some way. And I'd just be like, what? Everywhere I went. So this is sort of taking whatever that was and just, you know, focusing it the way that like a magnifying glass focuses the sun, right? It's just white hot sometimes. But it is, you know, it's been such a journey for me personally, because I started in memory of and in honor of a niece who died, and I started at a crisis line, and I did all the training, and it was time to start picking up that phone. But first we got to listen to other people who were there. And I really couldn't get past the listening stage. They were like, okay, you ready? And I was like, no, I think I need to just listen a little more. And they're like, okay, well, it's been weeks. Ready? And I was like, no, I think I need to listen. They're like, what are you afraid of? I said, I'm afraid that somebody's going to say to me they want to die. You know, somebody's going to tell me they're suicidal. And in spite of all my training, that's not a conversation I'm comfortable having. And now it's a conversation I have sometimes weekly.
And I was going to ask you actually about, you do such incredible work for suicide prevention, and it's become a massive part of what your drive in being over 300 interviews into your podcast. Was it your niece that's giving you that personal connection?
The niece I started at the crisis line for was not a death by suicide, but since then another niece did die that way. I've had two members of my family die by suicide. And no, it didn't take that, it being the podcast, did not take that turn. I started it in part out of the desire to perhaps help some family avoid the pain that I witnessed and felt. But the podcast did that on its own. You know, when I started, I thought, and we'll do a suicide episode. We'll talk to a family that has experienced that loss. I just had no idea that the Venn diagram of depression and suicide overlapped the way it does. And yeah. And not even with the experience and the loss, but the thoughts. And I had not yet labeled my thoughts as suicidal because I didn't realize it was a spectrum. And I didn't realize that the chronic daily wishing to not wake up is, you know, on that spectrum. I thought it was the planning and the desire, I don't know if that's the right word. I don't think it's the right word, but to take the actions to end your life. Now, it's kind of hard for many people not to have them overlap just because of the prevalence and how common those thoughts are.
Yeah. And I just want to pause on that, because before this conversation today, like when normally I interview people for the second time, I listen back to the previous conversation, and it helps kind of prep me. It helps kind of key me back into, you know, their perspective really well. It's also, side note, kind of nice, because I listen back thinking, oh, this was a few years ago. I'm sure I'll be an awful interviewer. And I'm often pleasantly surprised that I wasn't too bad back then.
You know, you were not.
But I remember you spoke about that differently then. You said that you hadn't ever felt suicidal. And I sort of echoed that similarly. I think I said something along the lines of, you know, I've never felt it, but, you know, I did have certain thoughts. I had thoughts about what it would be like if I wasn't here anymore. I had thoughts about what my funeral would look like, how people would react to me no longer being here. And, you know, a lot of that mindset was imminent. You know, it wasn't me thinking in 60 years, what will my funeral be? And so that's so interesting to me that we've had that similar but separate journey, that we've then had to circle back and realize, oh no, there were suicidal thoughts there. And we'd got caught up in some of the stereotyping and maybe even some of the stigma that, oh, I wasn't suicidal enough to use that word.
Right. Yes, I didn't know passive suicidality was a thing, that wishing to be dead or not caring if you were. But like, I just did the CSSRS, the Columbia Suicide, I'll not be able to come up with the words, but you can Google CSSRS. And it asks, I think, 6 questions, sort of starting with, do you ever, and this is where I am, you know, do you ever wish to not be alive, or go to bed and wish you didn't wake up? You know, that's sort of the beginning stage. And then, you know, the last one is probably should be dialing 911 or whatever you have. So as I say, I didn't know it was a scale. I thought believing that you had lost your value as a human being and that no one would care if you weren't there was not a suicidal thought. And I now recognize that it's certainly the seeds of one if it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're so right about that crossover with depression. And in a way, it does kind of give me hope that suicidality is so much more common than is commonly acknowledged. And in that, it is so survivable. You know, when you really dig into it, when you get to have conversations with people that have been there and be surprised just how many people have, even if like us, they didn't necessarily even realize that was fully the extent of it.
Right. Right.
Those are all people that survive that. You know, the idea of being a suicide survivor is mm-hmm. so often kind of bound up in stereotypes and often, I think in many ways, understandably reserved for those that have made certain plans or attempts. And I wonder
if... that's such an interesting point.
Right. And I don't know if there's a different word or whether there's something to be gained from broadening that definition.
Right. Like a suicide thought survivor.
Yeah. But I think there is something wonderful for me anyway. There's some hope there in thinking just how much of the time people survive it, just how in the vast majority of cases, those people are still with us and they are having conversations and they are so often getting help or, you know, moving past certain things in whatever way. And I'll just wrap up what I'm saying here with a quote you've reminded me of that I from Matt Haig, and he said on this link with depression and suicide, he says, "Suicide is not selfish. Suicide is normally death caused by the illness of depression. It is the final symptom, a final collapse under unbearable weight. Suicide is a tragedy. If you have never been close to that edge, try not to judge what you can't understand."
And be grateful. Be grateful you haven't been there.
Yeah. And so as we start to wrap up, I wanted to lastly ask you about a project you've been working on where you've seen so many of the links with those that you've interviewed and what you've learned from that.
Yes, it was a sort of a slow realization that I was feeling better, my sister again, who was my co-host then, that it helped us to know that depression, which we call a lying bully because it is, tells everybody the same thing. Very, very similar things. And certainly the categories. And I liken it to the bully on the playground, right? And if it's telling, you know, when I grew up, the trifecta was fat, stupid, and ugly. Those were the three things the bullies called people, which is probably a lot nicer than what they're saying now, but it was still hurtful. But if you heard them say it to someone who you knew was not one of those things, there's that little piece of you that's like, the jerk says it to everybody. You know, maybe I'm not all three of those things. Maybe I'm none of them. Maybe I'm two of them, whatever. Same with depression. And then we had the discussion that if it helps us to know that, we needed to get that information out. And we went through a whole dozens of interviews and found people describing what depression tells them about them. What does it make you think and believe and feel about yourself? And it's that I am a burden, that I am worthless, that I will not be successful, that I will feel this way forever, that there is no coming through this and getting back into some sense of self or light. You know, just, I am worthless. And when you hear 25, 30 different people say, I don't think anyone would understand that I just felt, and then you hear broken, 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 broken by different people. The impact of that. And also, I must say, it was a really just brutal, brutal project to edit because I heard that broken, broken, worthless, worthless, you know, for months. But I turned it into a 10-minute video because that was the limit for a national organization here in the U.S., NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I submitted it for their national conference, and it played. And we've gotten a lot of people who have said, I had no idea. And I don't know how much it will help, but back to that, the suicidal part that we've been talking about, if you can just push that big, heavy door, you know, from that dark room you're in, open a little bit of a crack, and some light comes in because you now know, oh, jerk tells everybody that it just might let you not believe at all. It does me. It actually does. Now, I have not been in the depths of depression again in a while. And in there, would I still believe it? I'll bet I would. But again, I'm living my life trying to avoid that slide in as far and as long and as deep as I went last time. So that's what I've been working on. And I can give you the link and people can listen to it.
I would love that. So we'll definitely include that link in the episode description. And we're at our time, sadly, because I could talk to you all day. Yes, it's so
I love it. And I just like hearing your voice.
Oh, back at you. Like, we came on the Zoom and I was like, well, your voice is still brilliant. I can see why you did so much radio and voiceover. But no, thank you so much for this conversation.
Appreciate it.
We'll get to go a level deeper in a moment with the bit behind the paywall and reflect on the conversation. But for now, thank you.
Nice. Yep. All right.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.